Well, now we continue our great drama. And you might think, well, what about religion? Where is religion? Well, in a sense, if you want religion to give you a coherent account of the universe and its place and our place in it, then that part of the religious impulse I hope to satisfy by giving you a coherent account of the universe, one that avoids dualism, God, the soul, and immortality, and all that, and just starts with how, as far as we know, things happened. 13 billion years ago, there was a Big Bang. And out of the Big Bang go particles, and from the particles, systems, and out of the systems, some were carbon-based with big molecules with lots of hydrogen, nitrogen, and oxygen. And then an amazing thing happened, life. And as I told you yesterday, we don't know when and how life began, but we know it did begin. We know that and we know that it's purely natural processes. You don't have to postulate anything supernatural. You see, there used to be a big debate between vitalists and mechanists. And the vitalists said, in order to have life, you can't have just biological processes. You have to have an élan vital. You have to have a life force. We don't believe that anymore. We now know that it happened from purely processes. And then from life you get animal life. And once you get animal life, then you get consciousness. And if you get consciousness, you get intentionality. And then today, we're going to see you get collective intentionality, and then amazing things happen. But on the way, you get language. And this is how far we are. So we start with a Big Bang, and we come up with speaking people and perhaps other animals. We don't know, but we do know that human beings talk to each other and write and otherwise communicate in language, and this is a stunning fact. As I told you before, the secret of doing philosophy is to allow yourself to be astounded by what any sane person takes for granted as too obvious. And I want to say we should be astounded by the fact that we are animals running around on the surface of the earth, and at some point, we started talking to each other. I can't tell you when or how it happened, but I can tell you what happened, and that's what I told you yesterday. You have meaning, speaker meaning. You have convention, where you conventionalize the speaker meaning into a sentence meaning, and then you have this amazing phenomenon, inner syntactic structure. You get structures inside the sentence, which can be freely manipulated. Now, another feature I didn't mention yesterday, which is worth mentioning also, in addition to compositionality, where you can figure out the meaning of the big unit by knowing the meanings of the smaller units, in addition to generativity, whereby you can keep generating new sentences, you get another feature. The elements have a kind of discreteness, that the word preserves its identity even through conjugations of the verb and the past tense and the present tense. It still preserves its identity. And this means that there are a certain number of discrete units that go to make up the sentence. So you can have a sentence with 8 words or a sentence with 12 words. But you can't have a sentence with 9.5 words. You have to have the whole damn word in the sentence, even though you're allowed to make variations in the word. All of that is phenomenal. And today, we're going to add an enormous addition, which the first step we'll call society. Okay, so we got these beasts running around. And then there's an amazing thing that happens. It's already happened by the time we got to language, and that is They learn to cooperate with each other. They have collective intentionality. And this, it turns out, is crucial for their survival, that by collective intentionality, by cooperation, they can do things that they could not do by themselves. That the hunters in the hunter-gatherer community can kill animals that are stronger and faster than any one of them, but they do it by cooperating. It's an amazing fact about hunter-gatherer communities that they can kill a deer by simply running the deer until the deer becomes exhausted. You think, well, the men get exhausted sooner. No, the men are very clever and they preserve their energies and cooperate with each other. Okay, so now we have, we will suppose, collective intentionality whereby humans cooperate. Now, this is a non-trivial problem. How can there be collective intentionality? Because I've told you that intentionality always has the form of a state with a propositional content. But how do you do it when there are different people sharing a collective state? You see, when you and I are playing in the orchestra together, or we're playing on a football team together, it isn't just that I am playing the violin part and you are singing the soprano part, but we are doing this together in order to perform the duet, in order to perform the piece of music that involves the two of us. Or when we are playing football, it isn't just that I am kicking the ball and you are kicking the ball, but we are playing together. Now, what does that look like? And this is a serious problem in philosophy, is how can we analyze intentionality? And the problem is that the analysis has to be consistent with the fact that all intentionality is in the heads of individual human beings. And if we want to analyze, we intend for these two people, how is it possible? Because all the intentionality that each has is in his or her head. Okay? That's the problem. Now, there's a standard solution to the problem that doesn't work, but I want to tell you what it is and why it doesn't work. The solution is to say, we intend, if and only if I intend, and I believe that you believe that I believe that you intend, and I believe that you believe that I believe that you believe that I intend, and so on up. And that's called mutual belief, where you get an infinite hierarchy of belief. And here it's I intend plus I believe that you believe that I believe that you believe, etc. Mutual belief. So this is the story. Collective intentionality consists of individual intentionality together with mutual belief. All right, does that sound right to you? I don't think that's right. I don't think that works. And I offer a counterexample to that. And here's how the counterexample goes. Consider people who have intentions together with mutual beliefs, but don't actually have collective intentionality. And the example I imagine is this. I imagine that the graduates of the Harvard Business School have been taught Adam Smith's theory of the hidden hand. For some reason, it sounds better in French. La main cachée, okay? Adam Smith wasn't French, but anyway, has the theory of the hidden hand, and the theory says, the way to benefit humanity is not to cooperate, but everybody go out and be as greedy and vicious and avaricious as you can, and humanity will benefit, because there's a hidden hand that makes people benefit if we're all selfish. Now, it seems to me, we imagine that the members of the Harvard Business School all go out to benefit humanity by being as vicious and avaricious and selfish as they possibly can and not cooperating with anybody else, okay? So they satisfy this condition. I intend to benefit humanity, and I believe that you intend to benefit humanity, but we are not cooperating. There is no we intend, no collective intentionality to benefit humanity. And indeed, there's an explicit ideology. We must not cooperate. It must be each person for himself or herself, because we're going to benefit humanity by getting as rich as we can. Does everybody get the point? I don't think there is an answer to this counterexample. And the reason is that it isn't just that they satisfy this condition and don't satisfy that condition. They satisfy the condition that each intends and has mutual belief that the others intend. But there's an ideology to the effect that there shouldn't be collective intentionality. Now, that's different from the case where they all get together and hold hands and say, let's cooperate in going out and benefiting humanity by our individual selfishness. That's not the case I'm imagining. The case I'm imagining is where there's no cooperation. There's just individual intentions plus mutual belief. All the same, collective intentionality exists. Now, here is the puzzle. This is typical of philosophy. On the one hand, you want to say there really is collective intentionality. There really are orchestras and football teams and armies and clubs. There really is collective intentionality where people cooperate. But at the same time, you want to say all intentionality is in the heads of individuals. It all has to be in individual heads. So what's the... If you can't analyze we intend as I intend plus mutual belief, well, there's a rather simple solution, and here's what it looks like. In each of our heads, in the team case, is we intend. That is the requirement that all intentionality be in the heads of individual human beings does not imply that it all has to be in the first person singular. There's no reason why it can't be just the case that I am doing what I am doing as part of our doing what we are doing. We are playing football. We are playing Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. And I am making my contribution, that is, I intend to do such and such because we are doing such and such. This is the case where I have my intention as part of our intention. The only reason I am doing what I do is that I am playing on the team and we are playing football. I am playing the violin because we are playing Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. In every case, you have an I intend. Something has to move my body, but it's only because we are engaged in a collective project. Now, I want to say this is the origin of human society, is the capacity to cooperate. And the simple biological forms of cooperation are in things like the family, where the family cooperates in producing and raising the children and in finding enough food and shelter so that the family can survive. When you get groups of families together, you have a community, and the community provides a basis for survival. Okay, so we've also already got, we started facts. We started with intentional facts about human beings, where the human being has a certain intentionality, such as a belief or a desire. But now we've got social facts. And a social fact is any fact involving collective intentionality shared by two or more animals. Any social fact is a fact about the collective intentionality, about the cooperation of two or more animals. But so far, we're still with animals. How do we get to human beings? The next step, I think, is absolutely stunning. And as far as I know, we're the only species that does it. Here's how it works. You take social facts, and some social facts consist of the assignment of function. So you assign functions to objects. And we know that the early hominids did this because we have found examples of tools that they used. We found stones that were obviously hammered and hewed to be in a shape that they could function as a tool. Tool using is characteristic of human beings. But the assignment of function. The assignment of function is not peculiar to human beings. Lots of animals assign functions. The chimpanzees can use a stick to dig the ants out of the anthill. The birds use the bird nest. The beavers use a beaver dam. So the assignment of function is not peculiar to humans. Do it, but they're not the only ones that do it. And you notice all functions are observer relative. The object has the function only relative to the assignment of a function. Now, we're blinded to this fact that all functions are observer relative by the fact that we often discover functions in biology. It was only in the 17th century that people discovered that the function of the heart was to pump blood. You see, the Greeks had very strange theories. Aristotle thought the function of the brain was to cool the blood. Well, we don't think that now. We have a more sophisticated theory. But in any case, functions are observer relative. How can that be if you can discover that the function of the heart is to pump blood? Well, you know by now that the ontological subjectivity of the observer relative phenomena does not prevent us from having an epistemically objective account of the phenomena. It's epistemically objective that the function of the heart is to pump blood, even though the assignment of function is observer relative. How does it work? In our case, we value life and survival. So when we find that the function of the heart is to pump blood, we find that it causes the continuation and life and the survival of the organism. So the evaluative component to the function derives from its observer relativity. Once you've assigned a function to an object, you can talk about misfunction, malfunction. Once you say the function of the heart is to pump blood, you can talk about well-functioning hearts, heart disease, heart failure, and those only make sense within the assignment of value. If we thought the only thing valuable is death and destruction, then hearts would be dysfunctional. We don't think that. We think life is valuable, so we can discover the function of the heart. The assignment of the function is observer relative, and that's consistent with the fact that the statement, the heart functions to pump blood, is epistemically objective. Now comes an amazing thing. We got the assignment of function, animals do that. We got social facts, animals have those. We have intentional facts, but there are some things that humans do that no other animal does. We assign functions to objects and people where the function cannot be performed in virtue of the physical structure of the object or the person, or not solely in virtue of the physical structure of the object or the person. And my favorite example are these sorted bits of paper that I carry around in my wallet. It's just a hunk of paper. It's a bunch of cellulose fibers. It's got ink stains on it, but you'd be surprised how interesting people find it. If you see it on the street, people rush over and pick it up. They'll stuff it in their pocket and save it. They exchange it for all sorts of valuable objects, and yet it's just a piece of paper. What's the big deal? And you all know the answer. It's money. Now, what fact about it makes it money? The fact about it is that we have assigned the status of money to this object by collective intentionality. That is, we use the collective intentionality of the community to assign a status to an object, and with that status, a function that can only be performed in virtue of the collective acceptance of the object as having that. I'm going to introduce a technical term here. It's the notion of a status function. And since this is going to be the crucial concept in this particular lecture, let me slow down and explain it. Humans assign assign functions to objects and to other humans. They use it as tools to dig with, and they exploit other humans in various ways. But humans have a remarkable capacity, as far as I know, no other animal has it, and that is the capacity to assign functions to people and objects where the person or the object does not perform the function in virtue of its physical structure, or not the physical structure alone, but in virtue of the collective acceptance by the community of the object or person as having a status, and with that status, a function that can only be performed in virtue of the collective acceptance of that status. So think of what it is to be a professor, or the president of the United States, or a policeman, or a husband, or a wife. All of those are status functions. In every case, you have a status that is assigned to some person, and with that status, a function that can only be performed in virtue of the collective acceptance of that status. See, when Barack Obama gets up in the morning, he's president of the United States because there is still the collective acceptance of him as having that status. It's commonly said by ethologists that animals have power structures. They have an alpha male and an alpha female, and then they have a power structure behind the alpha male and the alpha female. But there is no status of the alpha male, which is a result of collective acceptance. It's rather brute physical force. Every day the alpha male has to get up and figure out how he's going to maintain his position of power, and he needs cooperation of other males to fight off the males that are challenging him. Now notice an amazing thing. Barack Obama doesn't have to do that. He doesn't get up in the morning and think, who do I have to fight today? Who will arm wrestle me today? And who can I get to help me in the arm wrestling so we can stay in power? He doesn't have to worry about that because he's got a status function. He's got a collectively recognized function as the President of the United States. And I want to say this is the key to understanding human civilization, because it is what distinguishes us from other animals. Other animals have social facts, they have cooperation, they have power relations, but they do not have money, property, government, marriage, universities, cocktail parties, summer vacations, and sabbatical leaves. All of those are status functions. And they have presidents, chairmen of the department, husbands and wives, and secretaries. They don't even have the president of FIFA. They do not have things like where you have changing structures of power. Okay, now that's the basic notion in this lecture, and our puzzle is, how does it work? How do you assign these status functions? I said that the status function was performed independently of the physical structure. But if I want to put that more carefully, I have to say the physical structure alone will not give you the status function. There has to be an assignment of function. So, for example, physically, I'm able to drive a car. I have the physical structure to drive a car. But in the state of California, that's not enough. You have to have a driver's license. And this is a precious document. I don't know how it is now in Europe, but it's precious in the state of California. You can't even buy a beer without showing people your driver's license. Ha, there it is. You have a driver's license, and this is a precious assignment of status functions. So I am allowed to drive a car, not because I'm physically able, but because I have a driving permit. I am a licensed driver. Okay, so now we've got some amazing facts about status functions. They seem to carry power. The status functions carry certain types of power, but the power is a very peculiar kind of power, and it has names. Rights, duties, obligations, authorizations, permissions, and generally authority. And collectively, I call these deontic powers, after using the Greek word for duty, deontic. Okay, so that's our first notion, the notion of status function. That, I'm going to argue, is the key to understanding human civilization, because it confers power. And I have to explain the nature of that power, how it functions, how it locks into human rationality. That's our next topic. How do we create and maintain status functions? Okay, when I first worked on this, it seemed to me that all of the status functions were created by a single operation. And it was the operation whereby we count something as having a certain status, and with that status, a function that can only be performed in virtue of that collective acceptance. And the general form of that, I said, was X counts as Y in context C. It's obvious if you think of games, such and such counts as a legal knight move. Such and such counts as the black king being in check. Such and such a form of check counts as checkmate. As a person satisfying some conditions, I count as a professor in the University of California. Barack Obama counts as President of the United States, and I take it most of you count as citizens of Spain, and perhaps sometime in the future, citizens of Catalonia. X counts as Y in C. Looks like that might be the secret of understanding status functions, because when we create a status function, we take some person or object X, and we count it as having a status Y, but it's only relative to a context, that it is money or property or government, that it's a professor or a student or a husband or a wife. It's relative to a context that you assign the status. So my first suggestion was, that is the device by which we create human civilization. And you might think, well, that's too pathetic. X counts as Y and C. You're going to create civilization with that? And the answer is, well, it's more powerful than it looks, because it iterates upward indefinitely. Let me give you some examples. There's a hole in the bottom half of my face, and every so often it opens up and noise comes out. But some of those noises count as English sentences. And some of those utterances of English sentences, because of what I told you yesterday, count as certain types of speech acts. So this utterance counts as a promise, but certain kinds of promises count as legally binding obligations, and certain types of legally binding obligations count as, for example, getting married. Now notice what happens. You have X1 counts as Y1, but Y1 equals X2, and that counts as Y2. and you keep going up. So you made noises, you made a promise, you made a contract, you got married. And then in the state of California, when you get married, all hell breaks loose from an institutional point of view, because you now have spousal benefits. You have all sorts of rights and duties and obligations. You get income tax deductions, and you even get pregnancy leave from your university. Males get pregnancy leave from the University of California. I don't know what the hell kind of sense that makes, but they do. I know a guy who had a very difficult pregnancy anyway. So it's not so weak as it looks like, because it iterates upward. Also, it interlocks. So you never just have these facts about state as functions. They interlock with others. So you never just have money. I have money in my bank account at the Bank of America on Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, California. It's put there by my employers, the university, the regents of the university, and I use it to pay state and federal income tax and my credit card obligations and all those plane tickets I had to buy to get to Spain. Okay, now notice what's going on there. All of those words I used, Bank of America, University of California, they all name status functions. And now I want to introduce another notion. All status functions are what I call institutional facts. So we're talking about the fact that I am a citizen, a licensed driver, the owner of property, possessor of a professorship in the university, and a whole lot of other institutions that I'm involved in. So all status functions, without exception, are institutional facts. And on the earliest version of the theory, I'm going to make it more complicated later, I argued that all institutional facts are created by a certain type of rule that I call a constitutive rule. And we need to distinguish the constitutive rule, X counts as Y and C, from the regulative rule that just says do X. A regulative rule regulates antecedently existing forms of behavior. The constitutive rule constitutes the very behavior that it regulates. Now let me go over that distinction. The rule drive on the right-hand side of the road regulates, but the behavior of driving exists independently of that rule. So regulative rules regulate an antecedently existing form of but the constitutive rule doesn't just regulate, it constitutes the very behavior that it regulates. And again, the philosopher's favorite example is chess. It was not the case that a lot of guys were pushing bits of wood around on boards, and some genius said, "Fellas, we got to get some rules because you keep banging into my bishop with your knight." No, that's not the way chess works. The rules of chess don't regulate the pushing of the pieces. They're constitutive, because playing chess is constituted by acting in accord with a certain set of these rules. So the constitutive rules constitute a certain type of fact that I call an institutional fact. On close examination, it turns out all institutional facts are status functions, because all institutional facts create a status to which a function is assigned and can be performed only in virtue of the collective acceptance of the person or object as having that status. So we're starting to get an interesting equation here, and I want to spell it out explicitly. Here's what it looks like. You have status functions. Status functions equals institutional facts. And facts created by constitutive rules, the application of constitutive rules of the form X counts as Y by constitutive rules X counts as Y in C, and you have repeated application of that rule. Why do we do it? And the answer is because all of these institutional facts create power. And what kind of power is it? Well, I gave you the names. Rights, duties, obligations, authority, requirements, permissions, authorizations, and to have a general term, I call those deontic powers. Institutional facts, without exception, create deontic powers. Powers having to do with rights, duties, and obligations. And again, what's the big deal about deontic powers? Well, deontic powers, again, as far as I can tell, are unique to human beings because for the person who has the deontic power, there are reasons for action that are independent of inclinations. So some deontic powers are positive. The president has the right to veto legislation. Some are negative. The president is under an obligation to give a State of the Union address. Rights and authority are positive deontic power. Obligations and requirements are negative deontic powers. But the deontic powers are characteristic of institutional facts because all institutional facts carry rights, duties, obligations, requirements, authorizations, permissions, etc. I'm speaking rapidly because I just want you to get a feel for the extent of deontic powers as described by a language like English. Now, deontic powers are so important because they provide desire-independent reasons for action. They provide reasons for action that are independent of your inclinations. Let me give you an example. I have a wonderful time in Girona, but it often involves eating and drinking late into the night. Yes, late into the night. And the local wines have become fantastic. I don't want to tell you about how good they are because I don't want you to start thinking about wine. The problem is I then wake up in the morning and I think, do I really want to go and talk for 3 hours? And I don't always want to do that, but I do it. Why? Because I have made a promise. I am under a desire, I have a desire independent reasons for showing right here, hungover as I might be, and giving you a lecture. I have a reason that functions independent of my inclinations. And notice, it isn't that, well, you're really inclined to do it. Even in days when I'm not inclined to do it, I have a reason for doing it that's independent of my inclination. Now, our theory of rationality has no way of coping with the standard theory you find in economics with desire in the reasons for action. But they are the key to understanding human civilization because, for example, they're what's characteristic of ethics. Ethics and morality are about having reasons for action that are independent of your inclinations. How can that be? Well, if you can recognize the validity of the reason, you recognize that it's the basis or can be the basis for forming a desire to do the thing because you're under an obligation to do it. The obligation doesn't derive from a prior desire, but the desire to do it comes from a recognition of the validity of the obligation. I once gave a lecture in Chicago to a famous bunch of Chicago economists who are famous for thinking there are no such things. People just act out of selfish reasons, only to fulfill their desires. And I said, well, how about me being in Chicago? Nobody comes to Chicago in the middle of the winter for fun. The food isn't even any good. I don't leave California to be here just because it's so much fun to go to Chicago in the month of February, and I didn't didn't tell them that Italian restaurant they took me to was absolutely dreadful. But in any case, they said, well, but you're worried about what we would think of you if you didn't show up. And I didn't have the heart to tell them, I don't give a damn what you guys think of me. But, you know, these are famous right-wing economists. It was nice guys, perfectly well, guys like Gary Becker and so on, and they're perfectly intelligent economists, just they have a false theory of rationality. Higher independent reasons for action. That, I am saying, is the glue that holds human civilization together. So we get a remarkable set, we get a set of equations. All institutional facts are status functions. All institutional facts contain deontic powers. Deontic powers include rights, duties, obligations, etc., and they provide reasons for action that are independent of your inclinations. And they, for that reason, are the glue that holds human civilization together. See, as I have often boasted about my wonderful dogs, about Tarski and Frege and Russell, and they are wonderful dogs, but you can't get them to do something today which they will recognize as an obligation next Christmas. Okay, I can't get Tarski to recognize his obligations or even to think about what we should do on Christmas Day. You know, he can't be thinking, let's go to the zoo on Christmas Day, because in order to do that, he'd have to have a language that he doesn't have, and he'd have to have a set of devices for creating these institutional facts, desire independent reasons for action. Now, that is the secret of human civilization. So we went from the Big Bang to income tax. I'm not sure that's an improvement, but in any case, income tax does carry desire independent reasons for action. And you, if you look around your life, you are locked into a sea of institutional facts. You are a husband or a wife or a father or a son, and those have requirements and obligations that go beyond biology. There's lots more than just biology involved. You're a citizen or a student or a professor. You're the holder of a valid California or a Catholic Spanish driver's license. You're perhaps the owner of a car, you have income tax, and you're working for a degree in the university. You're in a sea of institutional facts. And of course, the interest of the institutional facts is that they lock into all the brute facts. It isn't just that it's all institutional facts, but for example, I made some gestures on a computer and I show up at an airport and they put us on an airplane and here I am. I altered my position in space and time in virtue of the institutional facts affecting all of the brute facts. I went from being in the state of California to being here. Okay, now, should we have a round of questions now? Because now it gets, it gets more fun, but more interesting, more complicated, because I didn't tell you about the real secret language, what happens. Okay, so should we have questions now? Okay, questions.
Questions from the back to the front.
Yes. Hi. I know that you've been talking about society and the rules that make society work. Yeah. But I am wondering if in this system, ethics system, is there a place for other suggestions in other ethics systems, like, for instance, the Kant system, or yeah, Alasdair MacIntyre, or... Yeah.
I haven't given you a theory of ethics. Does everybody hear the question? The question is, is there room for other systems of ethics, like Kant or Alasdair MacIntyre? I didn't give you a theory of ethics. All I said, ethics has in common with institutional reality that it has desire independent reasons for action. Now, one of the interesting things is, what sorts of institutions do we have reason to accept, and what sorts of institutions do we have reasons to reject, and what sorts of institutional facts should we recognize as binding and what kind not. So the account that I've given you of institutions, the account is this. Institutions are systems of constitutive rules. Rules of the form X counts as Y. And that includes money and property and universities and government and marriage. Some of those institutions are good or beneficial. I think money is benefits all of us, that there is such an institution. But some, like slavery, are evil institutions and I should be abolished. So what I have told you so far does not give you the criteria for distinguishing good institutions from bad institutions. Now, the subject of ethics and political philosophy was revolutionized by Jack Rawls. John Rawls said, I will give you a criterion for judging institutions, and that is, what would a rational being accept in the original position under the veil of ignorance? I don't know if you know about this, but it's a very important theory. I'm not here to expound somebody else's theory. I'm telling you my theory about the nature of institutions, and so far I haven't said anything about how to judge which are good and which are bad. I think Rawls is off to a good start. I think Kant doesn't give us enough when he tells us, well, it just has to satisfy the categorical imperative. Can you will it to be a universal law? That's a bit too abstract for me. I want it to be able to benefit human beings. Okay, so I'm answering a different question. I'm answering, what is the ontology of human civilization? And the answer I'm giving is, human civilization differs from animal societies in having more than social facts. It has institutional facts. Institutional facts carry rights, duties, obligations, requirements, etc. That is, those are deontic powers, and deontic powers give you desire-independent reasons for action. Now, one thing, another thing I didn't tell you is typically, not always, but typically, institutional facts require status indicators. You have to have some way of showing that you have the status. So I was showing off my California driver's license. The driver's license, it attests that I am a licensed driver. It solves an epistemic question. How do you tell who can drive and who can't? If you've got a license, you're legally authorized to drive. So it's an indicator. Policemen's uniforms or military uniforms, wedding rings, certain kind of clothing are marks of status. When I first went to California, if somebody had a tie and a jacket on, he was probably a professor, because the professors wore ties and jackets. Then came the 1960s, and if he had shoes on, he was probably a professor, because the whole pattern of clothing changed. So you do get these fluctuation in status indicators. There's a question here.
Do constitutive rules allow for exceptions whereby something counts as X, but it doesn't count as Y in a certain context?
Yeah. Well, you have continuous debates about what counts as having a certain status function and what not. The most famous was in 1980 when the election, I told you, the presidential election in the United States. See, winning a majority of votes in the Electoral College counts as becoming president-elect of the United States. But in 1980, it wasn't clear who won the majority of votes in the Electoral College, because it wasn't clear who won the state of Florida. And the state of Florida was such a tiny number of people that involved the difference between winning and losing, that really it was kind of a tie. And Americans have a method for deciding these issues. It's quite irrational, but it works. It's called the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court made a decision. Doesn't matter if it's an intelligent decision or not an intelligent decision, the Americans will accept the Supreme Court as deciding legal questions, as deciding questions of status function. So George W. Bush became president of the United States in a disputed election. question. It wasn't obvious that he satisfied the X condition, but Americans will accept it. The secret of the functioning of status functions is there has to be collective acceptance. And revolutionary movements try to alter systems of collective acceptance. And one thing they need to do that is to change the vocabulary. So in the Bolshevik Revolution, they didn't want to use the traditional forms of address. Count Tolstoy was not to be called Count Tolstoy, but was to be called Comrade, and everybody was going to be Comrade. And then I don't know what it was like here, but in the feminist movement in the United States, the feminists didn't want people to use the word lady and gentleman. They wanted just women and men, because they saw ladies and gentlemen as carrying status functions. I assume something like that must have happened in Europe as well. So you do have these constant disputes about who actually satisfies the X and the Y term. Who's a professor and who isn't a professor? What counts as tenure? What counts as a PhD degree, which is a status function, without which you can't get an academic job? And now there are all sorts of phony universities. If you pay them enough money, they'll give you a degree. Anyway, I won't tell you about all the horrors of that. Okay, any other questions? Yeah.
Yeah, John. You're talking of assignment of functions and, but now let's think of another example. The examples you give us are quite clear, good examples of what you're explaining to us. But let's take another fact, which I think it's basic and quite important in human civilization, that I don't know whether it has
satisfaction.
Let's take friendship, two people becoming friends.
Yeah.
Not comrades, two people becoming friends. Is this a process of assignment of functions and then a status functions recognition? It is rather a process of emerging something out of other things. We do things together, and then suddenly one starts thinking, believing that the other has become a friend of his. Yeah. The other, I don't know whether he admits that the first person is a friend of his, but at some point other people start saying, look, they are friends. So it doesn't look as an assignment of functions. It rather looks as if they were recognizing things.
Or the recognition of a pre-existing status function. I think that's right. And one of the fascinating classes of cases are informal status functions. Is this a friendship? Is it a real love affair? Or was it just, you know, we had a good time? But if it's a love affair, then it looks like that's a status function. What's the test? The test is always the same. Is there a deontology? Are there rights and duties and obligations? Now, in a friendship, it's clear. They're the obligations of friendship. As your friend, I am under an obligation to do certain things for you when you need help. So friendship and love affairs, I think, are status functions. And again, to repeat, the test is there a deontology? Are there rights and duties and obligations? If there are, then you've got a genuine case of the assignment of function. You have the assignment. Now, you point out, well, sometimes it's not an assignment. It just kind of grows, you know. I don't have to say, honey, I'm assigning you the status of my lover. That's, you know, you're not going to get very far if that's the rhetorical strategy that you use. But something has to grow. Now, I haven't told you how it does. And the secret, I'm going to tell you this after we all have a cup of coffee, is language. How does language work in all of this? And I haven't told you that, but that's going to be crucial. There's a guy there. Oh, yeah, sorry, you're next. Yeah.
You said that the animals are social too.
Yes.
But the difference institutionalization that humans have institutions.
Yes.
And then maybe we can say that the socialization of animals can be explained by Darwinian processes, but the institutionalization maybe not.
Well, okay.
Is that possible to say
it seems
that?
To me there is no question. You see, the two principles on which this whole series of lectures are based are the atomic theory of matter and the evolutionary theory of biology. So here we are. We're the product of animal evolution over millions of years, and we're physical systems. And now the question is, how do we get the peculiar structure of human civilization? And I'm saying the distinguishing feature is the status function assigned by a constitutive rule. What about animals? Animals do have power hierarchies, as I said. They have an alpha male and the alpha female. They have struggles for power, and it's great to see them. By the way, a friend of mine runs the Max Planck Institute in Leipzig, Mike Tomasello. He's an American, but you know, to their credit, the Germans will let an American run the institution, and a wonderful feature, all the language spoken is English in Leipzig. Anyway, here's Mike, and he's got all these primates, and the primates are busy having these daily struggles for who's the alpha male. Now notice a very interesting point. The primate does not think, I am the alpha male. No, that's the theoretician's attribution. The primate thinks, I don't know, maybe I'm on top, or I can beat up this guy. But the status, they don't have status functions in my sense. Why not? The reasons for action are always desires or prudential reasons based on desires. There are no desire-independent reasons for action among the animals. Now, as far as we know, maybe, you see, people sometimes think, well, I'm making a plea for the superiority of humans. No, I'm not. I don't care. If there's a tribe in the Amazon basin, a tribe of chimpanzees that has a much more elaborate income tax system than we have, well, welcome to the club. I'm just trying to figure out what are the distinctive features of human civilization, and if they're shared by certain animals, that's okay by me. But I am making a strong claim. There's a difference in principle between power relations based on force and power relations based on obligations. And all institutional facts create power relations, but the distinctive feature of institutional facts is that the powers function independently of your desires. Now, typically, in elaborate systems, you have to add brute force. You got to have a police force, or you got to have an army. Why? Well, I'll talk about that when I talk about language. I can't say it all in one word, one sentence, but we're going to get to the power, how the power has to be backed. I was once invited to the Vatican, and I accepted immediately before they realized they'd made a mistake. And I love the Vatican because they don't need a police force. They don't need an army. They have this joke army of these Swiss guards going around in these musical comedy uniforms. It looked great to me, but there's no real power relation. The other thing that got me about the Vatican, I couldn't believe it, they practiced Christian charity. So for example, we were all put up in this palace, the Casa Santa Ana. This is just a little hut. Oh, yeah, it's a marble palace. We all went to dinner, and the speaker sat at one table, and the priest sat at another table. Well, they gave those priests better wine than they gave us, and I was plenty annoyed. So I got up from our table and went and put one of our bottles on their table and took one of their bottles and put it on our table. Nobody said a word. They turned the other cheek. They were a bunch of Christians. I couldn't believe it. Right there in the Vatican, Christians. And so I thought, I loved it. I anytime they want to invite me to the Vatican, I'm ready to go back. It was great. The one more, yeah.
Yeah, I'm interested in your explanation of collective intentionality.
Yeah.
You replaced the other explanation of the mutual beliefs.
Yes.
With the idea that we can think in terms of we.
Yeah.
I mean, we can say we intend.
Yeah.
Now, my concern is whether you are actually requiring actual psychological states or mental states. And in due case, which and how are them, because I guess we can think of what we would call a collective action, a collective project or whatever, but still with some of its members, some of the members of the collectivity not thinking in terms of we.
Yeah.
Especially, I'm thinking about parliaments, for example, yeah. How parliaments work. We would say that they are, in a way, collectivities, collective projects, but it's hard to think that they all are, all the members of a parliament are thinking in the same terms of we. Yeah.
Well, no, I think that's right. In any large group of people, you always get people who are not cooperating, who just are free riders, who go on for the ride. This happens in universities. There are some professors who don't do a good job. They don't care because, well, they got tenure. There was a guy at Stanford who wasn't doing any work, and the administration said to him, well, why don't you retire? He said, I already am retired. It's just that I get full salary. So this is very common. Armies, you know, any army, there are people who just, you know, don't want to get in any situation of danger. They just, they do what they have to do, but they're not cooperating. So this is common to have freeloaders, people who are officially members of the group, who are recognized as having the deontology, they have the rights and obligations, but they don't actually do their job. It's very common. And I have to say, it's common in academic life. It's not unusual in universities. Yeah, give him the mic. Yeah.
Given this fact,
yeah, I
don't
think
we need anything
is,
else to explain yeah. collective intentionality, but just the idea of this we intend in our heads?
I don't think anything is missing. So let me tell you what the account is. The account is this. You have a deontic system. It is an army or a ski club or a university or an orchestra or a football team. Everybody in there is assigned a status, and with that status, functions that derive from the status. Say is of this form, X counts as Y. So you have the assignment of the status functions, but you have some people who don't perform the status, who don't perform the functions that go with the assigned status. So the problem is not with the theory, but with the fact that a lot of people just find reasons not to go along with the requirements as stated by the theory. But I don't see that that's a weakness of the theoretical account. The theoretical account says, if you're a member of this club, you have the rights and obligations of the members of the club. The fact that you don't do your obligations, well, you've let us down.
Just a short comment. Ernst Tugendhat would say at this moment of the talk that there is one thing to recognize the obligation and the other thing is to perform
yes.
according to the
yeah.
obligation. And of course the deeper question is how much there is room for people who do not even recognize the obligation
yeah. Yeah.
and are they somehow part of the collective in which the collective acceptance exists.
Yeah. Okay, in case people didn't hear that, he makes a very good point. That implicit in what I've said is the distinction between recognizing the obligation and acting on the obligation. But what about the people who don't recognize the obligation? And that arises too. Much social change comes when people simply no longer recognize the obligations that were once assigned to their position or their status. An interesting status function is the status function of being a woman or the status function of being a man. And the deontic powers that go with these status functions are undergoing change. Watch the vocabulary. In American law, there is a traditional term called a spinster. A spinster meant an unmarried female, and it was a metaphor because these unmarried females did spinning. They had spinning wheels and did spinning. The word spinster has become obsolete because the status function of being a spinster is no longer recognized. I once asked my class, How many of you are spinsters? And one middle-aged woman had the courage to raise her hand because she's not married. I thought she ought to get an A in the course. This may be a word you're not familiar with, a spinster. But that's a case of a status function that's simply becoming obsolete. It's just changing and no longer recognized. It's when people say things, well, I have to do this because I'm a woman, or I have to do this because I'm a man, that they are recognizing a separate status, that they're representing a status function that carries deontology.